Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and today we'll be talking about some of the presentations that were presented at the ASCO Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium, or better known as ASCO GI, which was held as a hybrid event this year, both virtually and in person in San Francisco, California, in the United States, between the 20th and the 22nd of January 2022. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
In news around esophageal cancer, there was a three-arm randomized controlled phase 3 trial, which was called the JCOG-1109 trial. And it compared neoadjuvant DCF, which stands for docetaxel plus neoadjuvant cisplatin and 5-fluoracil, so 5-FU, chemotherapy. And it compared it to just cisplatin and 5-FU alone. So it's with or without docetaxel. That's the comparative. And this is called the NEXT trial. It's the other name is JCOG-1109. It took 601 patients and randomized them in three equal parts to the three different treatment arms. And after that, all the patients received transthoracic esophagectomy with original lymphadenectomy. The primary endpoint was overall survival of this trial. Pretty ambitious. The three-year overall survival rates were in favor of the DCF arm compared with the CF arm, so with the added docetaxel, and it was 72.1% in the DCF arm versus 62.6% in the CF arm. And that has a hazard ratio of 0.68 and a significant p-value. There was no statistically significant overall survival benefit of CFRT, so that's neoadjuvant CF with radiotherapy, over CF alone, and that was 68.3% for the CFRT and 62.6% for the CF alone arm. Although it had a good hazard ratio favoring the radiotherapy arm with a hazard ratio of 0.84, it was not significant. These results were consistent across subgroups. Moreover, the median progression-free survival calculation displayed superior outcomes for the DCF arm compared with the CF alarm, and those data had not reached complete maturity at 2.7 years follow-up, but currently it has a hazard ratio of 0.67. The safety profile of DCF was manageable, according to Dr. Ken Kato, who presented these results from the National Cancer Center Hospital in Tokyo, Japan. In patients treated with DCF, certain grade 3 or 4 adverse events were more common than in the CF arm, including neutropenia, which was 85.2% in the DCF arm versus 23.4% in the CF arm, hyponatremia, which was 26% versus 6.2%, febrile neutropenia, that's 16.3% versus 1%, and an appetite loss, which is 21.4% in the DCF arm versus 8.3% in the CF alone arm. Grade 3 to 4 esophagitis was more frequently observed in the CFRT arm at 8.9% than in the CF or DCF arms, which both had about 1%. Furthermore, the intensified DCF regimen did not result in an increase of postoperative complications or postoperative mortality compared with the CF regimen alone. Dr. Kato concluded that the neoadjuvant DCF regimen represents a new standard treatment in patients with locally advanced esophageal cancer, given that the overall survival benefit of this treatment and its manageable toxicity profile. Okay, let's go through the Phase 2 DESTINY-Gastric01 trial and the final results that were presented at the ASCO GI as well. This was a phase 2 trial that included 188 patients who had HER2-positive advanced gastric or gastric esophageal cancer, who had undergone two or more prior lines of therapy, including fluoropyrimidine and a platinum agent. Participants were randomized 2-to-1 to trastuzumab deruxtecan, or T-DXd, at 6.4 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks, or a standard PC chemotherapy regimen, which was irinotecan or paclitaxel. In the primary analysis, T-DXd outperformed PC chemotherapy on the primary endpoint of the objective response rate by independent central review. This presentation was held by Dr. Kensai Yagamuchi from the Cancer Institute Hospital of JFCR in Japan, and these were the final results of this trial that were presented. The objective response rate was 51.3% in the T-DXd arm compared with 14.3% in the PC arm, and that was, of course, a significant value. In the TDXD arm, 9.2% of the patients displayed a complete response and 42% of the patients had a partial response. In addition, 35.5% of the patients in the TDXD arm demonstrated stable disease. The median duration of response was 12.5 months in patients receiving TDXD versus 3.9 months in patients receiving chemotherapy. The updated overall survival analysis with a maturity of 71.1% represented superior anti-tumor activity in the TDXD arm over chemotherapy, with a median overall survival in the TDXD arm of 12.5 months versus 8.9 months in the standard chemotherapy arm. Dr. Yakimucci added that the 40% reduced risk of death in patients receiving TDXD, it's clinically meaningful overall survival benefit. The updated safety analysis did not show any unexpected safety issues. Grade 3 or higher adverse events were more common among the TDXD receivers than among chemotherapy receivers, at 85.6% of those in the TDXD arm versus 56.5% in the chemotherapy arm. The most frequently reported grade 3 or higher adverse events in the TDXD arm were decreased neutrophil count at 51.2%, anemia at 38.4%, and decreased white blood cell count at 20.8%. Notably, 12.8% of the patients receiving TDXD displayed interstitial lung disease, ILD, pneumonitis, after a median time to first onset of 102.5 days, and 13 of these 16 cases of ILD were grade 1 or 2, and so easily manageable. Dr. Yakimucci concluded that these updated results confirm that TDXD has the potential as a treatment option for patients with HER2-positive advanced gastric or gastroesophageal junction cancer after two or more previous lines of therapy. That was the DESTINY-Gastric01 trial. First-line options for patients with unresectable hepatocellular carcinoma, or UHCC, have been pretty limited, and sorafenib and lenvatinib are the main options available. This was pointed out by Dr. Ghassan Abu Alfa from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, the United States. And they said, quote, "These agents have been associated with a median overall survival of approximately 1 year and quality of life reducing toxicity." So recently, atezolizumab and bevacizumab outperformed sorafenib in these patients. And also tremelimumab, it's a CTLA-4 inhibitor, plus durvalumab, a PD-L1-like inhibitor, showed promising activity in this population in a phase 2 trial. And the current trial that was presented by Dr. Abu Alfa looked at the phase 3 Himalaya trial results, which randomized patients with unresectable HCC in equal parts, in three parts, to tremelimumab 300 mg single dose plus durvalumab 1500 mg every 4 weeks, and there were 393 patients in that arm, or arm 2 was durvalumab monotherapy, and there were 389 patients in that arm, or sorafenib 400 mg twice daily, and there were 389 patients in that arm. The primary objective was to compare the arm that received the 300 mg single dose of tremelimumab plus durvalumab versus the sorafenib, and look at the OS, the overall survival, as a result of that. The tremelimumab 300 mg plus durvalumab was superior to sorafenib in terms of median overall survival at 16.4 months versus 13.8 months, and that provided a hazard ratio of 0.78, and of course a significant p-value. The overall survival difference between the two treatment regimens increased over time, and the 18-month overall survival rates were 48.7% and 41.5%, while the 36-month overall survival rates were 30.7% and 20.2%. The superiority of tremelimumab at 300 mg plus durvalumab over sorafenib was consistent across all subgroups. Furthermore, the median overall survival for patients on durvalumab monotherapy was non-inferior to that of patients in the sorafenib arm, and that was 16.6 versus 13.8 months, with a hazard ratio of just 0.86. The safety profiles of the novel treatment regimens were manageable, according to Dr. Abu Alfa. Grade 3 or 4 adverse events occurred in 25.8% of the tremelimumab at 300 mg plus durvalumab arm, the 12.9% in the durvalumab monotherapy arm, and sorafenib, it was happened in 36.9%. So we know that's a fairly toxic TKI. Hepatic or hemorrhagic SMQ events were limited to the tremelimumab plus durvalumab arm, with 7.0% and 0.5% grade 3 or higher events in that particular treatment arm. The prevalence of immune-mediated adverse events met the expectations of the authors. In the most common grade 3 or 4 adverse events in the tremelimumab plus durvalumab arm and the durvalumab monotherapy arms were hepatic events at around 4% each, diarrhea at about between 3 and 4%, and dermatitis or rashes. So really interesting data, and seems like we can say that tremelimumab plus durvalumab, it did improve the overall survival of patients with unresectable hepatocellular carcinoma compared with sorafenib. The durvalumab monotherapy was non-inferior to sorafenib, so that answers that question. And durvalumab monotherapy and tremelimumab plus durvalumab had manageable safety profiles, and they could represent, or at least the combination therapy could represent, a new first-line treatment option for that very hard-to-treat population. The KEYNOTE-590 trial was esophageal cancer, and it generated a new standard of care. This was a pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy, and they looked at clinically meaningful benefits compared with chemotherapy alone as a first-line therapy in patients with locally advanced and metastatic esophageal cancer. This was a phase 3 trial, the KEYNOTE-590 trial, and it was designed to assess whether pembrolizumab could offer additional benefits over chemotherapy alone to patients with esophageal cancer. In total, 749 patients with locally advanced, unresectable, or metastatic esophageal cancer were randomized in equal parts to chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab at 200 mg intravenous every 3 weeks, or chemotherapy plus placebo. The primary analysis showed that additional pembrolizumab was associated with improved overall survival, with a hazard ratio of 0.73 and a significant p-value, as well as progression-free survival, which had a hazard ratio of 0.65, and anti-tumor activity in general. Dr. Jean-Philippe Metges from Brest in France presented the results after 12 months of additional follow-up. After a median follow-up of 34.8 months, so nearly 3 years, the data displayed that the benefits of pembrolizumab were maintained, with a median overall survival of 12.4 versus 9.8 months, hazard ratio of 0.73. and a median PFS of 6.3 versus 5.8 months in the standard chemotherapy arm. That's a hazard ratio of 0.64. The 2-year overall survival rates were 26% for the patients receiving pembrolizumab and 16% in the comparator arm, respectively. In addition, the 2-year PFS rates were 12% and 3%, respectively. The results were consistent across all predefined subgroups, including patients with adenocarcinoma. Moreover, the anti-tumor response data showed that 20.4% of the patients on pembrolizumab had a response duration of 24 months or longer. In the placebo group, 6.2% of the patients had a response duration of at least 2 years. Also, the quality of life, as they measured it, for patients in the pembrolizumab or placebo arm was comparable, although I do have to question the actual reality of how do you measure quality of life in patients in a placebo group that has to go to the hospital every 3 weeks for injections. Importantly, the addition of pembrolizumab was not associated with increased toxicity, according to Dr. Metges. The treatment arms had similar safety profiles, with 71.9% and 67.7% of the patients experiencing grade 3 or higher adverse events in the pembrolizumab and placebo arm, respectively. The rate of grade 3 immune-mediated adverse events was higher in the pembrolizumab arm at 7% versus 2.2% in the placebo arm. Dr. Metges concluded that the longer-term follow-up data of the KEYNOTE-590 trial confirmed that pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy is a new first-line standard of care option for patients with locally advanced or metastatic esophageal cancer, including patients with adenocarcinoma. In a combined Phase 2 and Phase 3 CheckMate 9x8 trial, they tested nivolumab plus the standard of care versus standard of care alone in the first-line treatment of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. This was a presentation held by Dr. Heinz Joseph Lenz from the USC Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center in California, the United States. And he said, quote, "The efficacy of standard therapies in patients with metastatic colorectal cancer may be enhanced by the addition of an immunotherapeutic agent," end quote. The combined Phase 2 and 3 CheckMate 9x8 trial investigated whether nivolumab, a PD-1 inhibitor, may deliver patient benefits when added to first-line standard of care. Patients with metastatic CRC were randomized to nivolumab at 240 mg every 2 weeks, plus mFOLFOX6 plus bevacizumab and there were 127 patients in that arm, or mFOLFOX 6 with bevacizumab alone, and there were 68 patients in that arm. The primary endpoint was progression-free survival. The primary endpoint, however, was not met, with the median progression-free survival reaching 11.9 months in both treatment arms. However, progression-free survival rates after 12 months were numerically higher in patients receiving nivolumab than in patients receiving standard of care only, with 15-month progression-free survival rates of 45% and 21.5%, and the 18-month progression-free survival rates at 28% versus 9%. The subgroup analyses numerically favored the nivolumab arm over the standard of care arm across all predefined subgroups. However, they weren't statistically significant, so take this data carefully. Furthermore, the objective response rate was numerically higher in the nivolumab, with 60% reaching the ORR versus 46% in the standard of care arm. And the median duration of response was also longer for patients on nivolumab at 12.9 months versus 9.3 months. Also, exploratory analyses showed that CMS1 and CMS3 subsets of patients were more likely to benefit more from nivolumab, as well as patients who displayed CD8 levels of greater than or equal to 2%. Further studies are warranted to select the patients who may benefit from this novel regimen. No new safety issues were identified, and the safety profile of nivolumab plus standard of care was acceptable, according to Dr. Lenz. The rate of grade 3 or 4 adverse events was higher in the nivolumab arm than in the standard of care arm at 75% versus 48%. The most common grade 3 or grade 4 adverse events among the nivolumab arms were neutropenia at 26%, decreased neutrophil count at 20%, and diarrhea at 7%. Any grade immune-related adverse event in the nivolumab arm were predominantly of gastrointestinal, so 42%, endocrine 22%, or dermatologic 27%. Origin. A bit disappointing, but we might find some clinical benefit for patients within this trial yet. One doesn't come across head-to-head trials every day of the year, so when there is one, I always pay attention and report it. This was a presentation held by Dr. Chiguza Morizane from the National Cancer Center Hospital in Japan. It was a look at etoposide and irinotecan and how they compare in neuroendocrine carcinomas. Dr. Morizane said, platinum-based chemotherapy regimens are recommended for advanced neuroendocrine carcinomas, end quote. Etoposide plus cisplatin, generally abbreviated as EP, and an irinotecan plus cisplatin, which is abbreviated as IP, are standard of care options for patients with this condition. However, it is currently unknown which combination is more effective. Therefore, the Phase 3 Topic NEC study was designed to compare EP and IP head-to-head in patients with advanced neuroendocrine carcinoma, and there were 170 patients that enrolled. The patients were randomized to either EP, which consisted of etoposide, which was 100 milligrams per square meter on day 1, 2, and 3, and cisplatin, which was 80 milligrams per square meter on day 1 every 3 weeks, or IP, irinotecan, which was 60 milligrams per square meter on day 1, 8, and 15, and cisplatin, which was 60 milligrams per square meter on day 1 every 4 weeks. The median overall survival was the primary endpoint of the study, and it did not differ significantly between EP and IP. It was 12.5 months for the EP combination and 10.9 months for the IP combination, and there was a p-value that was clearly not significant. Similarly, the median progression-free survival times were comparable at 5.6 months for the EP combination and 5.1 months for the IP combination. Also, similar objective response rates were observed for patients in the EP and IP arms at 54.5% versus 52.5%. However, interestingly, a post-hoc subgroup analysis did show that patients with pancreatic poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma may benefit more from the EP therapy, with a hazard ratio of 4.1. The safety analysis showed that grade 3 or 4 reductions in neutrophil count were more common in the EP group than in the IP group, and that was 91.5% versus 53.7%, so that's pretty substantial. Also, grade 3 or 4 febrile neutropenia occurred more often in the EP arm at 26.8% versus 12.2%. Notably, prophylactic administration of granulocyte colony stimulating factor, or GCSF, reduced the prevalence of grade 3 or 4 neutropenia from 27.9% to 9.5% in the first treatment cycle. Finally, patients in the IP arm experienced more any grade diarrhea than those in the EP arm, and that was 47.6% versus 23.2% in the EP arm. Dr. Morizani concluded that both regimens remain first-line standard of care options for patients with neuroendocrine carcinoma of the digestive system. Future studies should investigate whether additional immune checkpoint inhibitors may provide benefits for our patients. However, I think the data was really interesting with regard to the poorly differentiated carcinomas, and I think that that's something worthy of investigating too. Well, those were the six presentations that we selected to share with you from the ASCO GI this year in 2022. It was held in San Francisco. I think it was a great meeting, and there was lots of really valuable data, not just the positive studies. I think there's a lot of interesting data with negative data showing combinations that did not make a difference for patients. And that's always, of course, hard to hear, but it's a rich source of data. Thank you so much for listening, and stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.